Hey everyone, I'm Sky Hawthorne.
And I'm Samuel Marcus.
And this is Climate Hour.
So, this podcast was born out of an idea that Sky had last semester that Sky should probably tell you about because it was his idea.
Yeah, well, I thought, I want to do a climate podcast. Problem is, I don't know anybody in the environmental science department as interested in climate change as I am.
So he went to the obvious place that you would go to if you were looking for somebody who's interested in climate change, your structural geology teaching assistant.
And I said, hey, you want to do this podcast with me?
And it just so happens that that structural geology teaching assistant is way more interested in glaciers than he is anything else. So here we are. I am a third year undergraduate who's taken a couple of gap years. I'm passionate about glaciers, about snow, and about mountaineering. I've been passionate about mountains since the first time I was a kid in Maine and I saw these little low mountains along the coast. And when I went out west and for the first time I saw a glacier in Glacier National Park, I was just enthralled by how huge and powerful these things were. So when I had a chance to go to Alaska last summer and traverse the Juneau Ice Field with the Juneau Ice Field Research Program, I jumped at it. Since then, I've been delving into glaciology work. I'm actually working on a project at the intersection of structural geology and glaciology right now, and I'm hoping to go on and get a PhD in glaciology.
And I'm just like a guy, you know? I'm just like a dude.
But no, you're a very special dude.
I'm a very special dude.
Who really likes a couple of specific Twitter accounts.
I do really like a couple of specific Twitter accounts. I am a lifelong weather geek, at least since the age of like 7 or 8. I love tracking storms, particularly storms along the West Coast. And as storms along the West Coast have become fewer and fewer, I have become more and more interested in tracking wildfires and learning about how drought and wildfires are affecting the American West.
Today, we're going to be talking about wildfires with Joe Biacci, a lawyer and lifelong California resident currently living in the town of Dutch Flat. Joel, thank you for starting this pod with us. I saw you were traveling after today. Where are you planning on heading?
My wife and I are going to Little Corn Island off the coast of Nicaragua.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's a small island, no motor vehicles. Yeah, it should be a blast.
That sounds pretty fantastic. Like,
just a vacation or are you there on business?
Just a vacation. Just, you know, walk around, enjoy the local food, do some fishing.
Sounds like the dream.
Like a tropical Mackinac Island.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, where's Mackinac? What's that?
It's a tiny island in, do you know if it's Huron or Michigan?
I don't.
Yeah, it's a tiny island in the strait between Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, I think. That's this old resort destination, and there's no cars on the island.
That's very cool.
And it's known for walking around and enjoying local food and fishing, but, you know, probably none of them as good as in Nicaragua.
So, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about your area of expertise, what you do, and your personal experience with wildfire.
Sure. I'm a native Californian. Was born in San Jose, and then when I was about 12, the family moved to Paradise, California, in Butte County. And if you're not familiar with California, that's kind of the northern part of the state, in the foothills. And then went to school at Chico and then graduated law school at UC Davis, then went to work in Santa Barbara. And then about 25 years ago, came back up to the mountains to raise our son. The town I live in is on the west slope of the Sierra. It's an elevation of about 3,800 feet and maybe a 45-50 minute drive to Lake Tahoe.
What's the town?
Dutch Flat.
Dutch Flat. I have been through Dutch Flat. My experience
really?
With Dutch Flat, I actually had a pretty formative memory there. Age 7, traffic getting stalled in Dutch Flat for several hours, having to put on chains on everybody's car going up.
Okay.
The hill. I remember being pretty resentful of Dutch Flat.
So you didn't get into the town at all?
I did not get into the town.
Okay. No. It's a small town. You know, we've got a little convenience store, post office, a couple of churches. That's about it.
Nice. And you've lived there for how long again?
Since mid-90s.
And so you have, do you have your own practice out of Dutch Flat?
Yes. For a while, I was commuting to Sacramento, working in one of the big downtown firms. And then when my son was about 2 or 3 years old, I realized I wasn't going to get to see him grow up. So in about 2003, I opened my own practice up here. It's been a blast. It really has, because I'm the only lawyer probably about 20 miles in any direction. And a lot of the folks up here, they're not going to go to Sacramento or go down to the valley to see a lawyer. So I have a lot of people doing estate plans for the first time. I enjoy this much more than the corporate commercial world.
So your specific area of expertise is estate and property laws.
Right now it is. Back when I first started, I did a lot of litigation, which is a young man's game. So now it's, real estate, estate planning, and then I kind of have a couple of niches. I have a client who develops veterinary biologics, and they've been a long-standing client, and that's a lot of fun to work on too.
Nice.
Someday we'll talk about vaccine licensing.
that's a I'm sure there's multiple podcasts worth of material right there.
yeah.
All right. Well, if you feel like diving in, we'd love to know a little bit about just going deeper into what your life was like in Santa Barbara before the paint fire.
It was Santa Barbara. If you haven't been there, it's pretty big compared to Dutch Flat, but it's a wonderful place to live. You got the beach, a lot of nice places to eat, kind of a low key atmosphere, and the house that I bought was between Santa Barbara and Goleta. It was kind of a semi-rural environment. A neighbor next door had chickens, and it was not heavily wooded, but you weren't in town, so to speak. I bought the property in May or June of 1990. It was a seller's market at the time, and I had bid on two other houses, got outbid, and managed to get this one. It was located on a street called El Sueño Road. Less than a month after we purchased it, I was at work, and about mid-afternoon, an announcement went out that there was a fire at a transfer station, which was about a half mile or so from the house. And that's where the refuse companies would bring all the household trash and whatnot, and they'd sort it and then take it to the actual dump. So authorities advised people in the area to evacuate in case there was some kind of a toxic substance burning. So my then wife came out to my office, and we decided to order some pizza and go in a conference room at the office and watch a couple of movies. So we got about 30 minutes into the movie, and all of a sudden the power goes out. I'm like, what's going on? And I had drawn the blinds in the conference room so you could see the TV better. Opened it up, and the sky was just orange smoke, wall to wall. We still didn't know what was going on, but what had happened was up the hill, the Santa Barbara is bracketed between the ocean and a coastal mountain range. A neighbor had gotten ticked off at another neighbor and lit a fire. And on that day, we had what they call the Santa Ana winds, which is it's a wind driven by pressure gradients, and it comes down over what's called San Marcos Pass, the top of this coastal range, and flows down towards the city, then out to sea. So we decided to go home, not sure what's going on. And we were there maybe 30 minutes and decided we needed to get out. And I took my truck, just had time to I had a parrot at the time and got the parrot in the truck. And that was about it. I was literally dressed in a t-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. And like I said, this happened less than a month after we had moved in. I did grab, now that I'm thinking about it, a couple of old pictures of my grandparents, their wedding picture, and then my grandmother's first communion. And by this time, the area was heavy smoke. And you got to remember these more and more, we could talk about this later, the fires here in California are wind driven. I'm guessing the winds were 25 miles an hour with gusts up to 40. And as I came out of my driveway, went down the street, the embers were just everywhere. It was really a hellscape. Branches that were on fire, saw a cat that was on fire, a horse that escaped and its mane was on fire. And it's all bumper to bumper because everyone's trying to get out. We're just creeping along. Had the AC on, but it was still filled with smoke. Got down to there was a frontage road, which abutted Highway 101. And just as I got there, and then in this area of Highway 101, at that time, I think it was three lanes in either direction, total of six. It might have been two, but it was, even so, it was pretty broad. And just the heat and the wind coming down was enough to ignite a row of eucalyptus trees on the other side of the freeway. It looked like the opening scenes in Apocalypse Now. It wasn't an ember that started it. They just all, 15, 20 trees all at once just burst into flame. And here's something that's kind of funny. So at this point, it's still bumper to bumper. People are trying to get out. But the other lane, if you were for some reason want to drive into the fire, was empty. So I thought, I'm not going to wait here and, have this fire overtake me. So I got in the other lane driving the wrong way. And I look back and there's a police officer on a motorcycle behind me with his lights on. And I thought, well, I'll take the ticket, but I'm not stopping now. I'll wait till I get about a mile away. So I get about a mile up the road and the traffic had thinned out. I pulled over, he just kept going. So he had the same idea I did, just get out of there. As far as I know, all of my neighbors in that part of the area, they got out okay. There was at least one fatality.
There were two fatalities from the fire, I think.
Okay.
One of them was a firefighter who was an inmate firefighter.
Okay, and there was a woman who was trying to escape and was out in the open. It's amazing more people didn't get killed. You would have expected something like paradise because it just moved so fast and without warning. The next few days, the first thing I did the next day was went back up there to see if there's anything left, and there wasn't. The fire was so hot, the concrete was more like a chalk. I mean, you could just crumble it under your foot or in your fingers. So then I went, went to a store and got some needed clothes. So I got some boots and a shovel and a rake and went back and didn't find anything except in the garage was cut into the side of a hill, and in the corner of the garage on the bottom, I found a backpacking stove my mother had gotten me when I was 12 years old. It's one of those old style, I don't know if you've ever seen them, they're brass and
I've used them.
Okay, fits in a box. And I thought, and the psychological processes are interesting. It's like it just seized on that. It's the only thing I really owned other than my truck and my bird. So I set it down off to the side, didn't find anything else. Metal was melted. The engine block on my outboard motor was just a puddle of aluminum. It was solidified at this point. So I got my truck, backed up, and ran over the backpacking stove, squashed it flat. And I'm not what I would consider a mystical person. I'm not religious, but you know, there was this voice that came to me that said, "No, you lost everything." And I kind of realized, yeah, I guess I did. So one of the things that you know, people may not think about is when you have 500 homes burn in the space of a few hours, well, those people all need to go somewhere. So it was really difficult to find a place to live. Eventually, we did. But, you know, the rental market just gets squeezed instantly. And then, you know, the rebuilding process, probably the most difficult part was dealing with the insurance companies. When there's a mass event like this, the insurance companies have adjusters that go from disaster to disaster. And in my case, Farmers had a couple of good old boys from the South. I don't mean that, you know, in a derogatory way. They were brothers, Billy Bob and Bobby Bill. And
that's fantastic.
Yeah. And so, you know, in Alabama or wherever they were from, you know, you could build a mansion for $50 a square foot. But that's not true in California. So there was a lot of negotiation. I finally got them up to $100 a square foot and had to go to arbitration. So about 6 to 9 months post-fire, I finally knew how much money I had to rebuild. So then retained an architect, and then you have to go to the city and get approval. One of the things the city wanted was me to put in a turnaround on the property for fire trucks. And I lost my temper a little bit and said, look, the neighbors told me that, you know, the fire crew ran away. And I said, I don't blame them for that. If their lives were in danger, they needed to do that. But I said, why haven't we put in a turnaround, you know, if that's going to be the case? So they backed off of that. And there were other issues that, you know, they wanted me to reroute a big drainage pipe that was there.
Are we talking about the city? Did you have to deal with the insurance company, like in addition to dealing with the city, or did the city?
No, I dealt with the insurance company first because I needed to know what my budget would be. And I should mention that, you know, people think they're insured and really they're not. I happen to have on the house, I had a good policy. It was called, I forget the exact verbiage, but they would replace the structure. Okay. That's good because some policies will use some kind of depreciation or actual cash value or things like that. So that was the good news. The bad news was that it didn't cover things like repaving the driveway. And if you've ever priced asphalt contractors, they're not cheap. Didn't cover this rerouting of the drainage pipe that the city required. Another thing that people are unaware of is that, okay, in this case, I think I had $65,000 in coverage for contents, personal property, you know, TVs, clothes, appliances. That sounds like a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money until you go out and start replacing these things. You know, at that time, lawyers wear suits to the office every day, and I liked designer suits. Well, yeah, just replacing my work clothes was 10 grand right there. So I ended up, you know, not replacing a lot of things, at least not at that time.
You mentioned one of the things you mentioned in your email to me was that the insurance payout money only applies if you're planning to rebuild at the site that burns down. Was there ever a part of you that thought, gee, I wish I could take this money and relocate somewhere else? Was there trauma associated with rebuilding in the same place that it burned down?
No, you know, at the time, You know, I still like Santa Barbara. And it, you know, it was a nice piece of property, and there was the prospect of a new house. I mean, the one we bought was probably, you know, 40 years old, some deferred maintenance. And so you get, the insurance company does let you design your own house. They just, you know, you just have to live within their, the check they gave you. So yeah, no, that part was actually kind of exciting, designing it, you know, to your own personal needs and so on. But I think, yeah, and the requirement is going to be in your mortgage. The bank, you know, when they secure a loan with real estate, well, part of it's the land, part of it's the structure. And, you know, they don't want to end up with security that's worth a fraction of what they loaned because somebody didn't rebuild the house. So, yeah, but it's a problem. There was a problem for people who had other life issues. You know, maybe they were in their late 70s and, you know, looking at going into a retirement home in a few years. And, you know, what do you do then? You know, do you rebuild for a place you might even not even live in? And so, yeah, it was not difficult for me, but difficult for others. Oh, one of the things that I thought was interesting is how people panic in a fire.
Yeah, talk a little about that.
A friend of mine, another lawyer in town, his wife took all the bills, all the household bills. You know, I mean, here you are fleeing for your life and, you know, you take the bills. Another inexplicably took the dirty laundry, you know, the same, why everybody, I'm talking hundreds of cars, all stayed in the proper lane, you know, stop and go, when there was another lane that no other cars were in that would get you out of there in 2 minutes.
Did the woman who brought the dirty laundry with her, do you know if she brought any clean clothes?
Probably not. Yeah, strange stuff.
I think one of...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think one of the things that, and we go to school on the East Coast, and I think one of the things that people on the East Coast don't quite realize about fire season and having to evacuate from a wildfire is just how quick it all happens. You know, I grew up in California. If you keep like fireproof clothes under your bed, you have a go bag ready, like this could happen at 3 a.m. and you have 20 minutes to get out the door.
You're right. And it's a real sort of Damocles hanging over your head because you never know. I mean, I envy people in the South who get hurricanes, you know, you get 2-3 days notice. And yeah, and it's, I mean, CAL FIRE, which is the state agency that's fights wildfires. You know, you talk to them privately and they'll say, look, everything is going to burn at some point. It's just a question of when. And we've got, you know, we're dealing with climate change, of course. These droughts we've had in the last 10 years have changed the face of the area. You know, first we had the drought stressed the pine trees, ponderosa pines. We got bark beetles. I don't know if you've heard of that. They'll kill a tree in a matter of weeks. So we've got those, you know, some have come down, but there's a lot still remaining. And it used to be that when I first moved up here, you know, kind of the standard fire prevention for homeowners was keep the pine needles off the roof and clear a perimeter of 30 feet around your house. That's very doable. I mean, that's not that hard. But those requirements are expanding. So now, you know, they want 100 feet, certain things to be done. And if you live on a big parcel, that's now you're talking some work. And the other thing is that one thing I have noticed is that people in the foothills used to be, they didn't want anyone to touch their trees. You know, they'd tell you, I moved up here to be in the trees, and they'd tell PG&E, for example, and you're not cutting it down. That attitude has changed. But the problem is that you know, if you have a 100-foot ponderosa, well, your average homeowner, you know, with an 18-inch saw isn't going to be able to take it down. So I honestly don't know what we do, you know, to reduce the fuel load.
Was this the first home that you had owned?
No, I had owned a condo before in Santa Barbara.
Okay. And to get to the real question, how much did you think about fire before the paint fire? How much was that something that played into the way that people thought about things in Santa Barbara?
You know, it's funny. I had, before I got the condo, I had rented places, and there's a place in Santa Barbara called Mission Canyon. It's beautiful. And it's just big old oak trees, live oaks. And I lived up there, and I was actually worried about fire up there because it's a very narrow road to get in there. And that would have been a real catastrophe. But that's all I really thought about it. You know, when we first moved up here in the mid 90s, I didn't think about fire much. But now, you know, it's not just fire season, but fire season has gotten longer. We've had some fires this month, which formerly was unheard of. It used to be your fire season was, you know, June through, you know, October. Then you could kind of rest easy for 6 months, and that's just not the case anymore. It's like living in a place that has hurricanes, and all of a sudden, or not all of a sudden, but over the course of a few years, a hurricane can strike at any time.
Well, to provide a little bit of scientific context to the thing you just said, one of the trends that's happening in California and across the West is shorter and sharper rainy seasons. So you have a season that now starts maybe in November or December as opposed to October and November, and ends in March or April as opposed to May. And you get more and more storms as a result of these big atmospheric rivers that they don't hold as much of a snowpack. They don't produce as much of a snowpack. They lead to runaway vegetation growth when then the vegetation starts to dry out way earlier. So you just get a scene that's much, much harder in terms of fire maintenance and fire prevention in California. And you get much, much longer dry seasons. You know, June, July, August, September, we'll get sometimes parts of California will get up to 200 days without meaningful rain. So
that's true. And I'll, you know, it's anecdotal, but when I was growing up in Paradise, I was a hunter then, and dove season would open right around Labor Day. And I swear it seemed like 2/3 of the time we'd get a rainstorm that would move through. Now, the doves like warm weather, and the rainstorm would drive them, I guess, south, wherever they go. That doesn't happen anymore. I can't remember the last time we had a soaking rain, you know, in early September or even October. And then this year, I don't keep any records, but we had a massive rainstorm in October and a massive snowstorm at the end of December. And that was it. You know, we've had some small stuff come through, you know, an inch of snow, a couple inches, but I probably 90% of our precip this year has been from two storms.
Could you actually tell us a little bit more about what it was like growing up in Paradise and what Paradise was like in the 80s?
Let's see. I grew up there in the 70s.
In the 70s, sorry.
I don't think the 80s is probably that much different. But honestly, you know, for me, it was paradise. I was mainly interested in fishing and hunting. And, you know, there was just really good trout streams within a half hour drive. I'd take my dirt bike. Nobody cared then if you were, you know, didn't have a license or whatnot. We were a half hour from trout fishing, and, you know, a little bit longer to go down to the valley to fish for salmon and steelhead, and a little bit further to go bird hunting. You could deer hunt anywhere around Paradise. It was a great place to grow up. It really was a great place. I went to a Catholic elementary school and then a public high school. And it was, I couldn't have asked for a better place to grow up.
And so, I mean, you talked earlier about watching the fire unfold in paradise in 2018 and feeling like both sadness because of what you'd lost from your childhood and your adolescence, but also like flashbacks to the paint fire and what you went through.
Yeah, it was classic PTSD, which I've always understood exists, never experienced it before. You know, after the paint fire, you know, I was still in Southern California and, you know, has fires every year. And I would watch the fires, on TV like everyone else. And, you know, there was like some rational sympathies for the people, but that was about it. But I think the difference was in paradise, now everyone's got a cell phone and people were recording getting out, and they were getting out on a lot of the footage is from Pence Road, which was near where I grew up. And just the just seeing that first person view of you can't see and it's embers everywhere. And I had talked to a soldier who had PTSD from service in the Middle East. And he had said, it's not just a memory. It's like you smell things, you hear things. And that was true. I could smell the smoke. I could feel the heat. It's a very strange experience. But yeah, human psychology is so interesting, how we work. Of course, the fire destroyed the town. I mean, it's never going to be the same. They had a nice interactive map. So you could kind of go to different locations and see what was there. And, the house was I had lived in two houses. One was burned up. The other, quite frankly, was a dump. It survived, of course. My grandparents' places, were burned down. Places I had worked as a teenager, all gone. And it's like, never going back. I used to go up there every now and then and, kind of drive around and go fishing and whatnot. But it's all gone.
Did you still have any people up there when the fire came?
No, family had all moved out. There was some classmates of mine who had stayed there after high school, and a couple of them were on the missing list, but they showed up safely. So no, I really didn't. There's probably some people there, but I just haven't talked to them for decades.
So have you had brushes with fire and Dutch Flat?
No close brushes. You probably heard about the fire in Colfax last year. Was that the Bear Fire, I think?
River Fire?
River Fire, that was it. And the way the wind was blowing, if it had just shifted a few degrees, we'd be right in the path. I mean, as it turned out, Grass Valley, which is a big foothill community, was in the path, and they knocked it down. But yeah, when the wind's blowing towards you or even in your general direction, you can't go to sleep, because these fires, especially in a wind, and that's the one thing you can't prepare for, because when Cal Fire says, all right, clear, 100 foot perimeter, that's fine for what I think we would think of as a brush fire 20 years ago that just kind of creeps along the ground, maybe gets up into the crown of a tree, but mainly stays on the ground. These wind fires are just just embers just flying like bullets. A retired Cal Fire manager told me that he was in a helicopter on a fire. I think this, I don't know the name of it, but it was towards the coast. And he said they were on a, they were flying over a farmhouse that was probably had 500 feet clearance on either, all sides. And he said the embers were just hitting it like machine gun fire. And eventually it caught fire.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So would you say, like, from your personal experience living in the state for a long time, more and more of the state is increasingly vulnerable to wildfire? Like, areas that were not as vulnerable in the past are now basically becoming tinderboxes?
Yeah, there's no question about that. And no doubt at all, because, you know, we've got the expanding wildlife-urban interface going on.
Talk a little bit about what that is for people who don't know.
That's our areas where people are moving into the foothills in this case. And here I live in the trees, and Dutch Flat is not experiencing any of that kind of growth. The Grass Valley, for example, is, and, you know, you're adding a few thousand people, you know, every, I don't know, couple of years. And now you've got more and more houses and structures in the forest, and it's, you know, more stuff to burn. And I think what a lot of people understood from the Paradise Fire, because it just got so much video coverage, was that, you know, a house will burn as easily, you know, as a manzanita bush. It's, you know, it doesn't seem like it, but they do. It's an increasing problem, no question about it. I don't know, you know, what can be done about it, honestly. I mean, you can't, yeah, I just don't know that the scale of the problem is so big, because, like I said, you can have your house perfectly manicured for Cal Fire purposes, but, you know, if you've got embers blowing a mile, what do you do?
Yeah. So what's the deal for people who, like, either don't have fire insurance because they chose not to purchase fire insurance, or for people who are living in areas that these fire insurance companies literally won't insure anymore? What happens if their house burns down? Do they get any sort of protection at all?
There is a state, I'll say state-sponsored insurance pool called the California Fair Plan. And you can get insurance through that. And I don't have a lot of direct experience with it, but I understand that it's funded by insurance companies who contribute to it or agree to take a portion of these policies. But it's a fair plan, but it's not a good plan, because the coverage is just not that good. But to answer your question, a lot of people will go bare. You know, it's as the phrase goes, and just have no insurance, and just, you know, roll the dice, really. And there's a lot of cancellations too. I mean, I expect to be canceled every year.
How is that legal to kick someone off their fire insurance if they're able to pay, if they moved into an area knowing that cost of fire insurance would maybe be expensive, but they would be willing to pay the rate? Isn't that leaving them high and dry, basically?
It is, and a policy of insurance is a contract, and, you know, normally you're bound to the contract for the term, and, you know, at the end of the term, if either party likes it, they walk away. It would be a big deal for the state to force insurers to insure people. I can see some unintended consequences, you know, one of which would be premiums go sky high, because all of a sudden now you've got carriers having to insure high risk properties. My firm represented probably 20 to 30 homeowners from the Paint Fire. Mm-hmm. And the classic problem was that the insured would talk to their agent, who would say, "Don't worry, you're fine. You know, you've got enough insurance." Well, it turned out they didn't. And we had a interesting way to resolve the case with, I think it was State, no, it wasn't State Farm. I forget, it was one of the big carriers. And the insurance companies did not want these cases to go to a jury. And, you know, from our client's perspective, you know, they really didn't want to go in front of a jury. They just wanted to rebuild their house. And, you know, and courts and juries are unpredictable. So we decided to consolidate all the cases and have them heard by a retired appellate court justice. And so we spent a week at a private location in Montecito trying a case. And anyway, we prevailed and got these people their money. But yeah, as I said, the main problem was insurance agents just being a little too fast and loose with the sales talk.
Yeah. And not being able to pay out when a bunch of claims come through at once.
Yeah, because, you know, the agents are salespeople, but the loss is evaluated by an adjuster. You know, two totally different people, different departments, and they don't care what the agent said. The insurance companies tried their darndest to, you know, avoid what their agents were saying. But in the end, you know, you really can't. If you drive up to a office and it says State Farm Insurance and the authorized agent says you're covered, well, you know, you just need to train your agents a little bit better.
Do you know if there's been any sort of initiative politically within California to like expand wildfire protections to make the FAIR Plan stronger insurance to keep people living in California? Because I imagine that if fires continue to get worse like they are now, that'll become a, you know, there'll be more of an exodus from the state.
Yeah, I think Governor Newsom, to his credit, Governor Newsom has Dutch Flat connections. He has a second home up here, and he's spent part of his youth here, summers. As I understand it, his budget for CAL FIRE he's beefed it up, and it's better than it was. But honestly, the scale of what has to be done is so big, I don't know if it's even possible. But the other practicality is that most of the fires, not all of them, but most of them are going to be in, you know, the foothills and mountains. And all the votes are in San Francisco and Los Angeles, to a lesser extent San Diego. So I just politically, I don't think if push comes to shove, there's going to be any interest by the folks on the coast from, you know, protecting, you know, people. And, you know, there's also, to some extent, you know, a red state, blue state divide between the coasts and the in interior California.
Yeah. Has FEMA played any sort of a role that you've seen? And do you think that they should?
They do. I'm trying to think. I got, after the Paint fire, I applied for a Small Business Administration loan. And even though it says small business, this was a loan that had nothing to do with my business, but it was perfectly fine. I could use proceeds of the loan to rebuild because I was underinsured. And I filled out the paperwork, and being a lawyer, I got it in right away, and they called and said, "Hey, you're the first one." You know, great. And, you know, said, "We'll bring you the check next week." I said, "Good." Well, the day before, they wanted me to, it was going to be one of those oversized checks, you know, that you see on promotions, like Publishers Clearinghouse. And I just didn't like, you know, I didn't like the surprise. I didn't want the publicity. And so I said, no. FEMA, you know, I'm struggling to recall their presence after, say, the River Fire in Colfax. There's not a lot. And I would guess that probably what you can get again are more loans, which, you know, it's not going to work for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a different attitude now because housing has become a real problem in California, and the legislature's taken steps to help that, for example, by allowing new homes to be put on an existing structure. I mean, historically, if you had your house on your lot, that was it. You're not going to put in a second one, but that's the rules there have been relaxed. And, you know, maybe they can do something for people who get burned out.
Did your insurance rates go up in Santa Barbara after the fire?
You know, they did not. And I have no idea why they didn't, because you hear about that happening all the time. Just like I was saying earlier, I'm kind of surprised I haven't been canceled, because I hear about it all the time, and it doesn't matter if you've not kept your house, your property up, or you have. There just doesn't seem to be any reason. It's just a mystery.
Yeah, it seems kind of arbitrary how, I mean, it's like the same thing with health insurance, whether you get denied coverage for something, or a lot of it happens behind closed doors, it seems.
Yeah. And, it's interesting you mentioned health insurance. I mean, honestly, if health insurance can't be canceled, that's a pretty good argument that fire insurance shouldn't be either. I mean, housing is pretty necessity for everyone.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking of. I mean, it's like if we agree that, like, we should have a fire department, that's a necessity. It's not like we're gonna stop funding a fire department in an area that gets a lot of fires. To me, it doesn't seem exactly logical that we shouldn't, have fire insurance for everybody who lives in these super high risk zones, especially if without it they're gonna end up homeless and, relying on social services. And I was reading about some of the encampments of people who had to evacuate from Paradise and were still homeless a year later. And it's really heartbreaking to see.
And it's particularly unique when I think the most applicable comparison is probably flood insurance in the Southeast. But of course, in the Southeast, when a flood comes and goes, particularly as sea levels rise, the water stays forever. There's just going to be areas that are just, they are land now and they will be ocean. And that's not the case with wildfire, which I think makes it sort of an interesting question of why it makes more sense that you could choose not to insure something that you believe just won't be land that long versus something that is at a high risk for damage, but is not necessarily going to be gone forever.
Right. Yeah. And after the Paradise fire, people from Paradise, I mean, they were looking all over Northern California for places to live. It was not just Chico and Oroville, which are all in Butte County, but, Sacramento. It's a real impact.
I've got a couple more questions about Santa Barbara. You mentioned that about half an hour after you went back home, you and your wife decided to get out of there. Was there a specific thing that led to that choice, or was it just it got too intense?
It was getting intense. The smoke was heavy. It was windy. You could see flames, maybe, I don't know, a quarter mile away. You could see the glow behind other houses. So it was obviously, it was on its way down the hill. It was just, there wasn't even a question of, do we stay and try to fight it? It was that bad. It was a wall of fire moving, 30, 40 miles an hour.
I can't quite conceive of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just look at those videos from Paradise, and that's pretty much what it was like.
Yeah. Where did you stay while you were rebuilding?
Oh, let's see. A number of places. At first I bought a small motor home thinking I would just live on the property. But and I forget why that didn't work out, but it didn't. Stayed in a hotel for a while, and then my secretary's parents were traveling overseas, and I stayed at their place for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and eventually found a place over in Montecito, which, if you're not familiar, it's a very expensive place to live. And renting a place while your home is rebuilt, it's called an additional living expense under your policy. And it was kind of silly because the place we found was huge, had an ocean view, and the insurance company paid for that. But it's not anything we wanted. It was just the only place we could find. So it just didn't sit right. I just remember thinking, this is a waste of money. I mean, this is probably, you know, the rent here is three times what, you know, our place would have rented for. I just, you know, we're simple people. We don't live in this kind of luxury. And, you know, it had like a hot tub and a tennis court. Well, the hot tub was okay, you know, every now and then, but a tennis court? What am I going to do with a tennis court?
Point to point, how long was it from the fire to the moment that you moved back into to your rebuilt home?
Oh, let's see. It was almost 2 years, 17 months.
Wow. That's a long time to be sort of a free spirit, to be generous.
Yeah, you know, as I said, you know, getting the insurance money was about, I seem to think it was 7, 8, 9 months. You know, then you got to have the architect do his thing, and then you got to pull your permits. We had to get the approval of the sewage agency too, and then the builder starts. And then, of course, with 500 homes being rebuilt, the subs are all in short supply. You know, the stucco guy can't get there for a month, and that sort of thing.
Do you have any relationship or feelings about the fact that the paint fire, that the cause of it was arson, that it was intentionally set? Or do you think that, you know, obviously there have been plenty of fires where arson has been, there have been plenty of fires where arson has been the trigger, the spread of those fires has been heavily impacted by the conditions, whereas obviously plenty of fires have been started by lightning or by a PG&E failure. Do you have any thoughts or feelings or opinions about the fact that the fire that destroyed your home was intentionally set, or do you feel like it doesn't really matter?
Well, it's I guess ultimately it doesn't matter. Well, that's how I feel now, 30 years later. Probably at the time I would have, you know, wanted to strangle the guy with my bare hands. But honestly, you know, the Santa Barbara area burns a lot. You know, Montecito's gotten hit hard the last few years, and they got the mudslides after one of the fires. So, it, you know, it just would have been a matter of time. You know, I was down in Santa Barbara over the weekend visiting my wife's family. And just on a whim, I drove up El Sueño Road just to take a look at the place. And I was amazed how quickly everything had grown back. You know, it's been 30 years, but it's like, okay, this is primed and ready to go once again.
You was down in Santa Barbara, they had the Thomas Fire recently, right?
The thing that
struck me about that was that fire was in December. That should have been smack dab in the middle of rainy season, and it was huge.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, you just can't. There's just no time to rest anymore. This year, despite the two, you know, big storms, things are very dry. I'm seeing a lot of young trees die. You know, maybe 2 or 3 inches of diameter, which I, you know, was a rarity when we first moved up. And then in this big snowstorm we had, We had about 3.5 feet, and we've had more snow, but the drought stress, you know, this is what everybody locally thinks. We're not arborists, but we live in the trees and, you know, we know them pretty well. We had a lot of trees snap about halfway down, just split. And that is not something we've seen before. Maybe one or two in a bad storm, but I'm talking hundreds of trees throughout town. Just, you know, and I, you know, everyone seems to think it's just drought stress. And a lot of these were firs, which is a pretty strong softwood. It's what's used in construction. But boy, they were just sheer in half.
That's crazy.
And then the last question I have, and I think I'll probably let Sky take it from there, is you mentioned that you escaped with a parrot. Do you still have that parrot?
No. He kicked the bucket. He lived a long, about 10 years after that. Yeah. I'd gotten it when I was in, it wasn't one of the great big parrots that lived for 100 years. It was a smaller variety. And I got him in law school and just had him the whole time.
Well, I mean, I don't have a whole lot more questions to ask. I suppose that most of what I still want to ask is after everything you've been through with the paint fire and then, you know, watching your hometown burn down. You know, I say this as a California native, born and raised in California, never lived anywhere else until I came to college. But I have to wonder, have you thought about leaving California? Have you thought about moving somewhere else?
You know, to be honest, my wife and I have talked about it. But, you know, it seems like every place is going to have its problems, you know, of some kind or another. I mean, I have a friend in town who, you know, tired of the wildfire risk, and some of it was politics, but he moved to Wyoming. Well, Wyoming's a nice place in the summertime, but I'm not really up for, you know, 5 degrees, you know, with a, you know, 40 mile an hour wind. So when you narrow it down to, you know, where you would want to live, and then look at their natural disasters or their climate or whatever, we really haven't found any place that's, you know, that's, you know, orders of magnitude better. You know, my wife in particular said, I don't want to trade wildfires for hurricanes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been looking, because I know both my parents have thought about leaving California, and I've been trying to help them find like places that are supposed to become more habitable as opposed to less habitable as a result of climate change. There's not many. Not many of these places.
I do live in one of them. I live in northern Maine.
Okay.
I was gonna say, I've heard like the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes region is supposed to become more habitable, but the winters are not a joke.
Yeah.
And even then, for us up in northern Maine, it's a fishing economy. And it's been a fishing economy for a very long time, and particularly based around lobster. And lobster prefer cold water. So as the temperatures have risen, increasingly they've moved north. So there used to be a thriving lobster industry in Massachusetts that just does not exist anymore.
We still gonna try to get a lobster fisherman on the podcast?
that would not be difficult for me.
Make it happen.
But this is to say that, you know, even someplace like Maine, where natural disasters aren't really a part of the way that you think about things, you know, the occasional tropical storm might make it up there, but that's not really going to hurt people, because it's hard to have that, the geographic position as well as just how far north you are is a limiting factor. Even nevertheless, for us, natural resource deprivation is still a huge problem. So you're exactly right. It's not safe anywhere.
Yeah, you know, here's some food for thought, on a macro level. You're probably familiar with Donner Lake. It's near Lake Tahoe. It's right alongside Highway 80. And you look at it, and you think this is a classical alpine lake. It's surrounded by granite and trees all around it. And you think, man, this has been like this for, you know, millennia. But Donner Lake, and I forget how deep it is. 300 feet. That might be a total guess, but that seems right. just a few hundred years ago was bone dry. There's trees at the bottom that divers go down and hang out at. So you think about that. And I've often wondered if the California explosion took place in extraordinarily wet years. And that, you know, we built everything based on an assumption that it was always going to rain like this. But in reality, we're more of a desert.
That's crazy. I did not know that about Donner Lake. I drive by there all the time. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know that California is a land of extremes. In the 1860s sometime, the entire Central Valley flooded.
Right.
We haven't had anything like that in quite a long time.
But. Right. And, you know, and all that flooding, you know, brought all those nutrients down the mountains and, you know, spread them out. And we're, you know, we're living off of that, just like we're living off of groundwater in the Central Valley that, you know, using it faster than it's being replaced. You know, at some point, there's going to be a reckoning.
What do you think that reckoning is going to look like?
I don't know. I think it's going to be you know, the frog in the boiling water. I think things are going to get more and more expensive, just like they are with gasoline. You know, our sources of crude oil. You know, it's a fragile web, and it didn't take much to disrupt it. And so for example, you know, irrigation water, you know, farmers will always be able to find it. I mean, you know, when they complain, in some cases they simply can't get it, but let's be honest, you know, with money, there's always a way. So I just think our costs of living go up and cost of food production go up. And, you know, these fires we've been talking about, you know, those are great economic impact in every way. I think we just drowned ourselves in, you know, these hidden costs.
Yeah.
And, you know, people moving has always been, you know, that's the time-honored response of human beings to climate change. I mean, you know, used to be almost all indigenous peoples were nomadic in some sense, you know. Even in Paradise, where I grew up, I studied the Maidu. And yeah, they would spend, you know, the summers up in the mountains, and then in the wintertime, they'd, you know, move down closer to the valley. And so, yeah, maybe there's some kind of an exodus from California, but as I say, I don't know where they go. Maybe they all end up in Nevada.
Not that they have a massive amount of water to work with, but...
Yeah, that's what I mean. There's no perfect solution. You know, it's when I studied ecology in college, you know, there was always, I forget the phrase, but the idea is that when you look at something, you include all your costs. So it's like, if you're going to drive your car somewhere, well, it's not just the cost of gasoline. It's, you know, the wear and tear, the maintenance that has to be done, and so on. And if you were to really look at it, you would include environmental impacts and somehow try to include those.
Yeah, like the social and environmental costs, externalities.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah, yeah.
For sure. No, I think more people should think of it that way. I think it would be, you know, we'd have a more comprehensive understanding of what's going on if people were able to look at a situation beyond just how it affects their own personal life.
Yeah, yeah, that's a challenge. You know, I don't like it when it's imposed, because I think it should come from the heart, but because you get better compliance that way. But yeah, I don't know how we change our thinking.
Me neither.
Well, if you think of anything, let us know.
Yeah, build a better mousetrap. The world will be the path to your door.
All right, Joel. On that note, unless you have anything to add, yeah. I 100% agree. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for the chance to talk.